Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Jessica. Thank you for being our guest on today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have had a few moments to familiarize ourselves with each other. We have never met in person. We do have mutual friends. But before we dive into our conversation, why don't you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, I'm Jessica Cochalone. I am currently the Chief Development Officer with a nonprofit in the Central Virginia region called Elk Hill. I also am an adjunct professor at the Institute of Philanthropy here in Virginia at the University of Richmond. I live in Richmond, Virginia. I have a daughter, and we love to just kind of hang out in Richmond and hike around the city and the river.
Yeah, so I have a friend who does some fundraising in Richmond, and I've never done any fundraising there. So Richmond's kind of that interesting. You've got some interesting history in those. What does fundraising look like there?
You got big New England philanthropy.
You got like big tobacco companies and all that stuff, and so you have this sort of this convergence of values and history, right?
Right. We have big tobacco and big energy and a lot of families who've kind of made their roots in tobacco and energy. So we have, it can be awesome and amazing because we have a really generous community. Yeah. A lot of our families are really plugged in and tied in to nonprofits, but it can also make it hard for smaller nonprofits because if you're not tapped into those bigger families, it's often hard to get the community to rally around you. So I definitely can see the struggle. You're also dealing with the dynamics of the history of Richmond, Virginia. We were the capital of the Confederacy, so we have some of those dynamics still at play.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was thinking about too. You got big schools, you got Charlottesville not too far away. So you have that sort of political tension. You got big, you know, very reputable institutions of higher learning, but you have that sort of, you have all sorts of Civil War history and
So it's a dynamic. We have progressive and old kind of coming together and clashing, and it makes for interesting conversations and interesting dynamics. I think more on the positive than on the negative, but we are struggling with some of that racial equity conversations in fundraising here in Richmond, particularly.
Yeah. I can appreciate that. So what's the topic that we're going to talk about today? Most of our guests do not sort of pull back the curtain on the conversation. So I'm anxiously awaiting what it is we're going to talk about today.
So my big idea today is focused on talent and fundraising and how do we create more diverse fundraisers in our community.
So what's your thoughts on that? I can assure you I've got some opinions on that, but I won't let steal the show. Go ahead.
I'm glad.
Yes.
Well, I think we're so sorely lacking diversity, and this is obviously a big thing here in Richmond because we have such a diverse community and a much more diverse community, I think, than some states with such the historical tensions here. But how do we engage not just by color or race, but also handicaps or the LGBTQ communities? And for us in Richmond, we're solving that problem through intensive learning opportunities. You know, we know that fundraisers, in general, don't stay in our field for more than 15 to 18 months and less engaged for people of diverse backgrounds. And how do they see themselves in the fundraising community? And so we're trying to solve that problem here with a fellowship program, actually, where we have recruited 7 fundraisers from diverse backgrounds in the kind of first 1 to 5 years of their career. And we give them intensive learning opportunities. We give them kind of intimate access to our funders and our funding community. We give them mentoring and training over a year-long program. And we also give them access to some events and private experiences to help kind of build their skill set.
So before I offer my opinion on this, can you pull back the curtain a little bit more on who these young people are and what type of work they're doing?
Sure. And they're actually all not young. They all actually come from a variety of, what we found is that, several of them are, second career. So they were either program officers and a nonprofit. We have one that actually did, government contract work in her previous career. And she was, her daughter was involved with a nonprofit called Art 180 here, which is using art for kids to express, kind of keeping kids engaged in programming. And, her daughter was a recipient of the program, and she was just really active as a volunteer and engaged with the nonprofit. And when their director of development moved on, the CEO recruited her. And she's a very non-traditional candidate, really. She doesn't have what we would qualify, say it's qualifications of a fundraiser, particularly a director of development would have, but she had 30 years of work experience outside of the nonprofit and fundraising community. She's a very smart, intelligent woman. And so they took a leap of faith. She's probably the most passionate person about that organization. And she became a director of development. Another woman was a program officer. She works, in the homeless and housing population. We have, a woman, a lesbian from, she works for a farm to table kind of food access nonprofit.
Yeah.
We have two of people actually from the YWCA. And we have one that does, kind of revitalizing old housing in the neighborhood. So I think it's a pretty diverse cross sector of our community. We also have someone with Commonwealth Charities too in the fundraising community. Some of them are younger, some of them are older. They all kind of took a leap of faith. This was a new program and really wanted to engage in conversations around what does diversity, inclusion, equity really look like in the fundraising community and how do we engage not only new fundraisers, but also the fundraising community and kind of look at how we're doing fundraising.
Okay, so I totally think I get, as best I can, a picture of who they are. So tell me about the work that they're actually doing.
That's a great question. So they spend half of their time. So they're with us for a full year, and they spend 1 day a month with us. Yeah. So the first kind of session is really a learning session. So we've had speakers come in and talk about equity and storytelling and how you tell people stories that are equitable and how you talk about your clients using asset-based strengths.
Yeah.
They learn and they're even having how do you like forecast your career and career trajectories and what does the CFRA mean for you. They're learning about how to be comfortable in uncomfortable situations. They're meeting, like I said, having intimate meetings with funders and learning about, you know, how philanthropists kind of view equity and diversity in that lens. And Now we're not just talking about funders. We're talking about individual donors too. And then they spend the afternoon really researching and kind of digging into what is happening right now around equity and diversity and inclusion in the nonprofit sectors. What are their own lived experiences? And it all will culminate with a white paper, or they're thinking about a toolkit about how do you, as a fundraiser, no matter where you're at in the sector, influence your organization to kind of really embrace diversity, inclusion, and equity in your organization as you kind of, you know, use your influence in fundraising, no matter where you're at in this organization.
So here's my thoughts on where I think we're missing the bar. And I think it, you'll have to tell me if you guys are trying to address this, but, cause there's lots of organizations I think that are trying to bring in a more diverse workforce in the fundraising space, but I don't think they're putting them. So I don't think they're, when it comes to the actual work that's being done, I don't think they're putting them close enough to the donor.
I agree with you. And that's what this, so what we've really heard, and I'll just be really candid on your podcast from talking, took 2 years to build this program, was we've had CEOs say, I've had an African American CEO say, like, I need a white fundraiser to sit in front of my donors.
Yeah.
We've also had other directors of Delman say that we've had diverse fundraisers and they're not comfortable being the only, you know, person in the room who doesn't look like them. Experiences by the woman who identifies as a lesbian, you know, just the uncomfortable nature of people having discussions about, you know, her partner is not a male, and when she gets asked that questions in social settings, like, so yeah, we're, it's really about getting these guys in front of the funders intentionally so they learn to be more comfortable in that kind of space, because we recognize that is an issue kind of across the board.
Yeah.
And then we are meeting with, we have some local funders who support some of a CEO. They have the CEO executive roundtables, and, you know, going out and really speaking to them about this experience and kind of having dialogues and conversations with them about it too. So I agree with you. That's really a big issue.
When I published my book 2 years ago, the diversity, equity, and inclusion discussion, I don't think was as hot as it is today. But when I published my book, I had a chapter in the back end of my book called A Tale of Two Ryans. And these two Ryans that I was describing, because I was addressing the fundraising talent question, but coincidentally, and only coincidentally, it certainly wasn't a deliberate move on my part, but these two young Ryans that I was describing were two white, male, straight fundraisers that I was saying have essentially figured out how fundraising really works, and they're moving through their fundraising career at a trajectory that's much more faster than the average, than what I thought most fundraisers would be moving through. Like someone like myself who's 25 years in. And what I think the diversity, equity, and inclusion folks are missing is that we're not putting these individuals, we'll call them this diverse pool of individuals like you're working with, if you do not put them in front of the donor and you do not normalize that lunch table where you're putting, a 65-year-old white woman from Richmond, Virginia across the lunch table from an African-American woman from Richmond, Virginia, who doesn't live on the same side of the tracks or something. You're not really training up either one of, you're not creating a cultural setting for either one of those. That's never going to become mainstream. And what I also see some of these programs doing, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this, what I also see and hear about these programs doing is they're just teaching this diverse pool of individuals to maintain arm's length relationships. And consequently, in my opinion, they're sort of self-marginalizing their career path. Like if you teach, if you teach an African American woman how to do direct mail really well in today's marketplace, and a guy like me is saying direct mail is going to be gone, and if you don't know how to take somebody out to lunch, you're not going to be a rock star in fundraising. then direct mail inadvertently becomes a disadvantage for her. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So part of the access to funders is we have seven, you know, fellows who have access to seven or eight funders. So they're having one-on-one meetings with them. Their sessions are either one-on-one or small group. Yeah. And once they meet with these donors, they're actually required to follow up with them and have a phone call with them and thank them and tell them, kind of give them some feedback on what they've learned and heard. So we are very aware of engaging. Yeah. I also think it's also, and we're not addressing this, unfortunately, it's a training of CEOs. It's really about, I mean, we're doing that in, you know, small conversations, but it's, you know, it's training CEOs. And I think the bigger question that we're not really addressing is the funder. And that's the elephant in the room, is that, you know, I have an African-American female mentee of mine who, you know, sitting in a room with her CEO and a funder, and he's saying things that are blatantly racist, not necessarily about her, but about the population they're serving.
Sure.
And she's horribly uncomfortable. She's 25 years old. It's not really her job to address that. It's the CEO's job. And so I think that is a piece that we're not really equipped to deal with. All we can do at our level of our influence in terms of, you know, helping the fundraising population is get them in front of as many funders as we can so they get comfortable being in that space and making those phone calls and know who they are. So when they see them out in the community, they can go and talk to them, because it's such an intimate one-on-one relationship they're kind of building through this program. I think it's just, unfortunately, it's such a sector-wide issue, and we're starting small, and hopefully we can start bigger.
Okay, so you and I are probably reading some of the same books, and I'm sort of very sensitive to the critique of who the funder happens to be in sort of our current sort of economic place where we happen to be in the world and in history. So are we going to, and I have a former African-American colleague of mine who came in and spoke to my class of students at the local college that I teach at recently. And we sort of had this discussion around the idea of, are we going to wait for the funder to, you know, the sort of the general profile of the funder to become more diverse and more representative, or are we going to deliberately target the non-white, non-straight, non-male donor, or is it something else? Or are we going to, do you follow my question?
I do.
Because I mean, it's kind of like the question of, do you want, it's not like it's dirty. It's kind of like these dirty money questions. Some of these dirty money questions that float around in philanthropy. Do you take money from a screwball or something, right? Some jerk. But now it seems to be the question, do you take money from a white person?
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, jump on it.
I think it's both. I think we have to own that there's a current way of philanthropy, and we have a responsibility to our organization, to our mission, to engage in that philanthropic space.
Yeah.
But I think we also have to make room for and think beyond the problem with fundraising and fundraisers in general. And no offense, I'm a fundraiser. We're all short-sighted. We're all up against a deadline. We all need to raise our annual budget, and we can't think about sustainability.
Yeah.
And we need to be thinking about sustainability. We also have limited resources. I mean, I'm in a small shop. I have a staff of me and two direct fundraisers, and sometimes it's split between grants and events, too. And so saying that I'm going to, you know, take one of my fundraisers and take half their time to kind of cultivate, you know, donors who don't have as much return on investment immediately but will long-term, it's really hard to sell to anybody on my board, right? Like, you're looking at, you know, possibly a 5 or 10 year window. That's a hard sell. And so, again, it's about a CEO and board education about, and I think a sector-wide issue about sustainability, that, you know, that if we're looking 20 or 30 years down the road, that is the right path. I think it's the right path because it's like humanity, like, you know, but it's also like business sense to me. Like, you know, if we want to make sure that we're relevant and we're sustainable, we need to be engaging with all a very different population of funders now, you know, today and tomorrow.
Yes.
I don't know that I wish I had the answer to that, because it's an issue I struggle with in my own job. Like, how do I carve out even 20% of somebody else's job to just engage diverse populations? I mean, shoot, for us, even millennials would be, you know, like, it, you know, there's just a lot of ways.
Well, so you hear it,
you know.
So one of the things, so let's say I'm having a, I come from I have a deep appreciation for the small shop, and that's sort of the world where you're at right now. But I talk to these, sometimes I'll have a guest on here, or I'll be talking to someone at a conference, and they'll be in higher education in some of these very large shops. And I generally hear this language of this culture of metrics. And it's this idea that everything's based by performance-based metrics. And if you're not making enough meetings and then therefore yielding enough, you know, gifts and enough gifts at a particular size. And so what you're hearing is you're sort of hearing this very utilitarian sort of notion that we've got to raise X number of dollars at all cost. And then interestingly, these are large, you know, I'm thinking of like one large D1 university, for example. They've got somebody over in a new, you know, diversity, inclusion, equity sort of role on the other side of the campus who hasn't sort of connected that the advancement department is sort of driving at a cultural norm and pattern and habit or whatever that's never going to work in alignment with what he or she is trying to accomplish over in her department. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Which is interesting because, I mean, if you look at the demographics of college students and alumni, which again, I realize are smaller donors, but they are the future of these universities.
Yes,
so
totally.
Being able to spend some time focusing on how do you really talk to these donors. And, you know, I will say for Richmond, our community foundation is trying to lead the way, and they're doing a whole study on Black philanthropy wealth in the Richmond, Central Virginia region. And so trying to just start dispelling some of those myths, because I think that's part of it, right? It goes back to education, is that there is money in these communities and there is philanthropy happening. It just, you know, the kind of mainstream philanthropy isn't plugged into it. And I don't know if we even understand it, you know, or we don't even know necessarily how to tap into that market or what that kind of market looks like. So I think for us in Richmond, this is a really good starting place of like, now we have this report, we're engaging, you know, some broader Black philanthropists in this conversation of what it really looks like in Richmond.
Did you see that? You had to follow the story. So I found it an interesting contrast. I thought about writing about something like this, but I quite honestly, I don't have the margins. But the so you recall the story here just in the last 6 months or so where the African-American billionaire pays off the student loans for the 100 students, the graduating young men at Morehouse College in Atlanta, right?
Right. So
we all heard that story. I thought it was a remarkable story. And for advocating for philanthropy, I think that's extraordinary, right? Here's a guy who has made extraordinary wealth and he does something very meaningful for like 100 young men or something. But what I also saw on social media, primarily on LinkedIn, was sort of this disdain and sort of this critique that wasn't blatantly, you know, you nor I would be able to get away with calling it blatantly racist, but I knew I could sort of see in the language that was being sort of spoken that it really just had to do with the fact that this was a non-traditional donor doing something for a group of African-American men that sort of didn't fit the mold of what philanthropy has historically done. It's just kind of irked me, you know what I mean? And I think that's part of what we in fundraising, because there is a large, you know, I'm a white straight male who, you know, generally fits the profile of a lot of major gift officer types out there, I suppose. And it's going to mess with our sort of way of thinking about who that donor is and the decisions they're making. And it's going to sort of make us sort of pause and think critically about what they're doing. Cause what I think that guy did was amazing. And if he had did it, if he did it for a group of my alums at my school, I would have thought it was amazing there too.
Well, yeah, it shocks your senses of what you know as the way we always do things. If you're a philanthropist who gives, you generally give through a big endowment. It goes into a fund. You get your name on a building. Like he's doing it because it's the right thing to do. And not that I don't think philanthropists obviously are giving, caring people, but he's not getting his name on a building.
No,
right.
He's
like
not.
He's not getting a scholarship for this gift. Like, so, I mean, I think in some sense, it truly is like a shock to our traditional way of philanthropy. And we it's almost a personal attack, a front. It's a strange.
Oh, that is insightful. Jessica, right? that is insightful. I had never thought about, yeah. I mean, how many white millionaires have names on university campus buildings? And here's a guy who gives I never thought about it that way. That's brilliant.
Yeah. So, you know, we got a lot of our identity. I think a lot of people have their identities, particularly when you're looking at large gifts. Their identities are kind of wrapped up in, you know, their philanthropic giving. When you're giving millions and millions, I give a little bit of money, but it's very wrapped up in my identity and how I feel about, you know, things in the world and where I want to see change. And so
yes.
It can be shocking.
There's a guy at Stanford. Before I let you go, I'll ask for your thought about this. Okay. So there's a guy at Stanford. He got the PhD in, economics or something, 10 years ago. Roth, R-O-T-H is his name, Alvin Roth. And he talks about market design. So it's the idea that marketplaces sort of inadvertently happen. But in fact, in our sort of modern economy, we can actually design these things. And one of the things he talks about is that, now he's talking about kidney exchanges, right? So kidney, you know, the exchange of organs, right? And that there are actually transactions that happen in our modern world that we don't want to transact money for. So we don't want people selling their vital organs. And what he called these things is he calls them repugnant. So these are transactions that some people don't view to exchange or to transact certain things isn't as honorable, or we wish people wouldn't sell these things and that sort of stuff. And he has not applied. I have not seen him apply his theories to philanthropy, but I think that's part of what we're going to have to reconcile as our world becomes more, as more people participate in philanthropy, and as we become a more aware, more diverse, more pluralistic society, you're going to see people putting money, significant money, in places that are true to them that are not going to be true to you. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah.
We're going to have to be completely okay with it. Yeah.
And it's going to be a struggle because it doesn't align with, and it's interesting. It should align because, if we talk about being donor centered, which I have a lot of feelings about, but we won't get into it on this podcast.
Yeah, let's not go there today.
Talk about truly being donor centered.
Yeah.
But in that model, it's like either wherever the donor wants to, then that makes the most sense, right? Like aligning with the way the donor gives or wants to give, that's true donor centered. I mean, right? Like, but it's such a shock to the way that traditional philanthropy works because it's not necessarily about that. It's still, as much as we want to say it's you know, relationship based. And in some sense it is, but it's still transactional. We're giving you something. We're giving you all this recognition. We're putting your name on the building. We're making you feel special. We're giving you events, private access to things. Like there's still a transaction going on there.
Yeah.
And in a way that I don't know that we as a philanthropic community are willing to really talk about or address, that there's still transactions happening.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel as good. It doesn't feel as good. And we're seeing that more as the tax changes have happened and the NAP credits are no longer, at least here locally, you know, NAP credits are no longer as beneficial. Like giving has changed and shifted. And we have a lot of donors that are just in it for transactions, and that's okay. I think we got to be okay with that because that's why they give. And it is having an impact on ways people give money.
There's an essay in the textbook that I use for my students that talks about the complexity of the nonprofit sector. And it's one of the first essays I have them read. And it basically sort of gets down to this idea. And I always use this example that the nonprofit sector essentially represents organizations like Catholic Charities in contrast to organizations like Planned Parenthood. And that to be a true advocate for the nonprofit sector, we have to advocate essentially for both of these organizations that represent values that are in, you know, stark contrast to each other. So I'm, part of that first couple of weeks in that particular class, I'm trying to get my students to sort of recognize that the nonprofit sector as a whole represents these very, you know, very opposite type organizations that represent, you know, values mm-hmm. that are completely on the other end of the spectrum. And yet that's what it's all about. And that's what it's here to do. Right. Whereas like McDonald's and Burger King are still saying, hey, people, you know, we're going to sell cheeseburgers. And so it doesn't have near the complexity that, you know, the for-profit sector doesn't have near the complexity that I think we have here in our sector.
Yeah, that's it. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Interesting article to read.
I have had your attention. You've had mine, and I have enjoyed this conversation. You are certainly, Jessica, always welcome to come back. If somebody is listening to our conversation today and they're saying, I want to reach out to her, I want to continue this conversation with Jessica, how would you suggest that they do that?
Oh, they can find me on LinkedIn at Jessica Cocciolone, C-O-C-C-I-O-L-O-N-E. It's the easiest way to kind of message me.
Okay, good. Well, we will put that information in the show notes, and thank you again for being on the show today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Have a great day.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.